Thanks, Tony. Thank you for the title. Thank you for the arm twisting. Tony's title was, what's the minimum amount of mathematics that a theoretical physicist needs to know? The self-respecting theoretical physicist needs to know. So I'm not giving a transparency talk, but there's a rather well-known blog written by Peter Voigt called Not Even Wrong, and this talk was advertised on that blog yesterday. So he, in fact, at tea yesterday, I also discovered that there are lots of people who like the idea of making lists of the amount of mathematics that everybody ought to know. So Peter's list is PDEs, Fourier analysis, complex analysis, Riemannian geometry, blah, blah, blah. And then there are 11 responses as of 15 minutes ago, in which people point out all the things that he left out. So this is not going to be a talk in which I enumerate all of the items that people are supposed to know. This is going to be a talk about the relationship between mathematics and physics. And I'm going to advocate more of a philosophy than a specific list of topics that one needs to know. So, you know, the other thing Tony didn't mention is that he gave me almost no time to prepare this talk. So I'm just going to talk for an hour, and I'll write on the board once in a while. I'm sorry I don't have too many visual devices. The first point I want to make about the relationship between mathematics and physics is one that was made very eloquently by Wigner in a well-known article from the early 60s called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics as a Tool in the Natural Sciences, plus or minus, I don't quite remember the title. And Wigner's point was that we don't have any right to expect that this activity, this human intellectual activity called mathematics, in which we try to discern the patterns that are used to organize things, would have a right to describe the nature that we see around us. So as an intellectual activity, mathematics takes input from the real world, but goes off in its own directions and is attempting to classify and organize patterns that are seen by human beings when they look at mathematical objects. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time about the philosophy of mathematics, but it's really a remarkable thing that natural science, and in particular physics, can be so well described by mathematics. But the history of physics has a lot of examples of cases in which the scientist, the theoretical scientist trying to explain a physical phenomenon, was unable to do so with the mathematical tools that he was aware of at the time. So the reactions to this were a little different. Now, I'm doing these in historical order. And the earliest ones, there's no distinction between mathematician and physicist. That's a later invention, a later development in human intellectual activity that we sort of split apart and went our own ways. But as we all know, Newton was unable to describe the dynamics, the physics of motion, in a fundamental way without also introducing a completely new mathematical tool. So Newton invented calculus. To describe motion. So this is not a sort of case where Newton was able to go off to his local mathematician and ask him, what good ways do you know that I might use to describe motion? He actually had to do the work himself. And that's one thing which has happened a number of times in the past. A second example I want to give, which is probably less well known, is the work of Fourier. So again, I'm hard pressed to decide whether to call Fourier a mathematician or a physicist. Fourier's training was in mathematics more than in physics. On the other hand, he was a student of people like Laplace, who also I think is hard to characterize as being either a mathematician or a physicist. This was still only, 150 years after Newton, unless I've got my centuries wrong. And the development of mechanics was still kind of somewhere in between mathematics and physics. It hadn't really separated quite as much. So Fourier was studying the theory of heat, and in fact introduced the what we now know as the heat equation. It was a partial differential equation with very different mathematical properties than the ones that had previously been discussed. People at that time had mainly studied PDEs that would try to describe, well, actually, I'm not sure that they had that many PDEs at their disposal, now that I think about it. My sense of what people knew in the early 19th century is not perfect. Fourier studied heat, and in the course of doing so, he found a very ingenious way to manipulate solutions to the heat equation, and he introduced what we now know as Fourier series. So Fourier series were met with almost universal when they were introduced. The notion that you could take a function like f of x and write it as an infinite series, this was fine. This was known to people doing calculus. They had things like Taylor expansions, Maclaurin expansions of functions. And those expansions had the nice property that when you took a finite number of terms, you got a better and better approximation to the thing that you were approximating, and you got the approximation that was better in a uniform way. Fourier, as we all know, took a periodic function and expanded it in some kind of, I'll write it in modern terms with the I, but he probably used sines and cosines, expanded it in terms of some other kinds of generating functions. And these Fourier series have the odd property that they can be used to approximate things that don't look like, to an early 19th century eye, don't look like proper functions at all. For example, a square wave. So if you have a square wave like this and treat it as a periodic function, then it's easy to use the techniques of Fourier series to write down an expansion for it. And as we know, the I don't know if I can draw this freehand so well, but the Fourier expansion of a square wave sort of does this, right? It's got big peaks and then little peaks, and as you put in more and more terms, the big peaks get closer and closer to the square, and the little peaks flatten out more and more. But there's no sense in which the approximation is uniform. And in fact, the approximation really can't be uniform because of this discontinuity in the thing that you're approximating. So having manipulated calculus, derivatives, Taylor series type expansions for going on centuries at that point, mathematicians were very loath to consider this new kind of series. And in fact, if you look at the history of mathematical analysis in the 19th century, this introduction of Fourier series and its eventual acceptance really led people to analyze very carefully what was going on with function spaces completely. They were a prime source of inspiration to Cantor, who introduced many infinite concepts and set theory as we know it today. And in a way, they led to the kind of crisis in the foundations of mathematics, which occurred with the work of Gödel in the early 20th century. So it's maybe a little bit of a stretch to trace that all back to the introduction of Fourier series, but it was a rather radical departure from the mathematics that was comfortable in the day. And in fact, the leading mathematicians dismissed it as being insufficiently rigorous. In fact, there was a little priority fight. I'm not sure if I'm going to get the history of this correct, but there was somebody named Biot who had published some form of the heat equation a few years before Fourier, but had done so incorrectly. He did not have the mathematical technology adequate to understand what was going on, and it was really only Fourier a couple of years later, through introducing this new tool, who was able to successfully understand that bit of physics. I'm not going to do this forever, but I'll give two more examples. Third example is Heisenberg. So, again, I'm not completely familiar with the history, but it's my impression that prior to the work of Heisenberg, nobody had thought of using infinite by infinite matrices for any purpose, right? I mean, Heisenberg realized that matrix mechanics was somewhere around the right track for describing quantum mechanics the way he wanted to do so, but that finite-sized matrices were not going to do it, and introduced this calculus of infinite matrices, which later got sort of massaged by mathematicians into a much more palatable form, the form in which we usually present quantum mechanics today with Hilbert spaces and so on. But really, in order to describe the physical phenomenon that he was confronted with, he had to go well beyond the tools that were common knowledge at the time. And my last example from, people are going to take issue with where I'm drawing the line between ancient history and modern history. So I'm going to call Gell-Mann ancient history, and then I'm going to call, the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, which was a couple years later, modern history, but never mind. When Gell-Mann in the early 60s was trying to think about trying to think of symmetry principles which were adequate to describe the zoo of experimental results in particle physics from the 1950s, he stumbled on non-abelian continuous groups. But SU3, so non-abelian continuous groups which are not equal to SU2. I mean, there's this story about how hard it was for him to find SU3, and then there's this trend in the 60s in the particle physics literature about. Okay, fine. So I'm not a historian. And I'm going to have a hard time making the case because the Yang-Mills paper, of course, is before this, right? So, the mathematics was there, and I guess my point is that in order to give the description, Gell-Mann had to go beyond what was considered to be standard mathematical. So David doesn't like this example. But isn't there this famous story that Murray had trouble figuring out what SU3 was, and he asked, pardon? All right. I'll take that example off. Anyway, I want to give a somewhat more extended discussion of a more modern interaction between mathematics and physics. In which, so this might go under the heading of missed opportunities. So again, I'm not the best historian for the purpose. But it's my impression from reading accounts of people who were involved in the work that had there been more interaction between mathematics and physics in the period between World War II and the mid-70s, things might have progressed much more rapidly. So the more modern interaction that I have in mind is, on the one hand, in mathematics, index theory, in particular the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. And on the other hand, in physics, the study of anomalies in quantum field theory. And really what was going on about both of these subjects was that they were independently developing many of the same ideas. So the story of the Atiyah-Singer index theorem is a quite pretty one. The signature index of a manifold started to emerge from the work of Hertzebruch in the 50s. Atiyah and Singer in the late 50s recognized that the phenomenon ought to be much more general. And through the early 60s, they constructed, they came up with a theorem which described what was going on as a special case of a what's called an index of a Fredholm operator. So this is an operator on a Hilbert space which has a finite dimensional kernel and co-kernel, and the index is the difference of the dimensions of the two. It turns out to have a lot of geometric applications. And Atiyah and Singer's proofs, there was a sequence of proofs, led to many developments in mathematics, including the development of something called K-theory, which turned out to be a natural setting for this Atiyah-Singer index theorem, as well as various kind of indices, including signature invariants of Riemannian manifolds. And it was a development that was happening purely within mathematics. K-theory was kind of in the air in the late 50s. K-theory, by the way, is the study of vector bundles on manifolds. Now, if you don't all know what that is, that was on Peter's list, right? The thing I had on the transparency, you're all supposed to know what these various things are. This has to do with vector bundles on manifolds from a topological point of view. And what those would have to do with this problem of calculating the difference in dimensions between the kernel and the co-kernel of an operator on some infinite dimensional space is quite an interesting story. And occupied two of the 20th century's best mathematicians for a good decade of their time. On the other hand, people were realizing, and again, I know the history of the mathematics better than that of the physics. So, David, when were they realizing? In the late 60s, perhaps. When is Jakeef? Yeah. That perfectly good classical field theories might acquire anomalies when treated as quantum theories, and people were struggling to find techniques for calculating these anomalies. And the techniques which they encountered turned out to be, when notes were finally compared in the mid-70s, exactly the same thing that was going on with the index theory of Atiyah and Singer. So this is a case where if mathematicians and physicists had been in better contact at the time that anomalies were first being studied, progress might have been more rapid. And in fact, I think, well, let's see, there are various ways in which the final version of this subject in particle physics is presented. In my view, the most elegant ways involve translating it into the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, but I guess the taste of some physicists is to leave it in the original language that was used by the people who first discovered the anomalies. Okay, so what lesson are we supposed to learn from all this? I think the lesson that needs to be learned is that it's difficult to answer the question that Tony gave me, how much mathematics is required. So how much mathematics? It depends. Oh, sorry. I forgot one other example. So the last example is one where the story is not complete, and it's a little hard to tell how our children and grandchildren will tell this story, but there have been a lot of attempts to explain something from condensed matter physics called the quantum Hall effect, which was observed, it's probably 20 years old by now, and recent efforts to explain this, so recent explanations, involve things like so-called quantum groups, which are the result of 20th century mathematics definitely being used. I should also point out, I mean, what I was partly trying to point out here was that this was a very modern mathematical topic. Again, this is a rather modern mathematical topic. People have been trying to extend the notion of a symmetry group to various other kinds of symmetry objects, in this case some of the most recent work seems to involve Hopf algebras, and there's also some non-commutative geometry trying to explain the quantum Hall effect, and mathematical tools which were not part of the standard toolkit of condensed matter theorists seem to be necessary to explain this. So how much mathematics? Well, it depends on what you're doing, exactly what you have to learn to get started. So it depends on which branch of physics, of course. And the lists will be different depending on the physical phenomena that you're trying to discover. But what I want to kind of emphasize here is developing an attitude towards mathematics as something which could be useful to solve the problems that you encounter. And that's something which not everyone who's working in theoretical physics has, right? So there's a, Tony quoted somebody from here as saying that some branch of physics could be done, 95% of it could be done with calculus. How many people believe that 95% of what they're working on could be done just with calculus? Yeah? Yeah, well, we knew it was Lars, right? The question is, what about the other 5%? What do you do when you encounter something that can't be done with calculus? Do you throw up your hands? Do you say, it's not a piece of physics I can mathematize? Or do you somehow look around and try to find some other mathematical tool which would be useful? And that's the point of view that I'd like to kind of advocate here. So so the attitude I'm advocating towards mathematics is acquire new mathematical knowledge, or be willing to acquire new mathematical knowledge, mathematical tools, when needed. Now, that's a hard thing to do. So I'm saying, go down the hall and ask your local mathematician what to do, but I'm not really saying that, because as most of you know, talking to mathematicians is very hard. So this is, we think about the world differently than physicists do. I'm speaking with my mathematician's hat on now. We're interested in the most general setting of some result. We're not interested in the specific case that you have in mind. So the people who were studying anomalies in quantum field theory really didn't care that the same techniques could be applied to vector bundles on Riemannian manifolds in arbitrary dimension. That was really not relevant to what they were doing. It turned out to be fortunate for them that that was true, because back when the anomalies were first, in quantum field theories were first discovered, people only ever studied quantum field theories in four space-time dimensions. And the fact that there was a tool which was available to study anomalies in other dimensions turned out to be very useful. For the condensed matter people in the audience, it's useful because you can go down in dimension. For the string theorists in the audience, it's useful because you can go up in dimension. It's a useful thing to look at in even space-time dimension anyway. You can get a lot of information by using these tools. The quantum Hall effect, I think, is another interesting example. This is something which was completely unexpected, which came out of the laboratory, which is really a challenge, has presented a serious challenge to theoretical explanation. And I'm not an expert, so please somebody jump in if I say something incorrect. But it seems to me that it's really ripe for people to work on or to attempt to explain using tools other than the ones that are traditionally used to explain two-dimensional effects. And that's what some of the more recent work on the quantum Hall effect has been doing. But how do you try to talk to mathematicians? the key thing is to remember sort of where they're coming from, and the fact is that they're going to answer a question with a greater level of generality than you hoped for. So you have to be patient with them and ask the questions over and over again in different ways. There's the other possible strategy, which is to go ahead and introduce your own piece of mathematics, as Fourier did, as I would say Feynman did in a way. I mean, the origins of quantum field theory in the immediate post-World War II period are really characterized by, an awareness on the part of Feynman and Schwinger and so on, that the kind of expansions that they were doing would not stand up to rigorous mathematical scrutiny, but also a real excitement that they had found a technique which was capable of solving the problems that they were trying to solve. And, you know, in a way what they did was somewhat analogous to what Fourier did. They introduced a new way of looking at what were essentially mathematical objects, which were good for calculating the physical properties that they needed at the time, even though there wasn't an adequate mathematical theory underlying them at that time. Actually, even still to this day, is there not a decent underlying theory for that? So some combination of inventing your own new mathematics and being patient with the mathematician down the hall is, I think, a very useful possible skill. So it turns out that when you prepare a colloquium on short notice, you have no idea how long it's going to take, and I'm sort of running out of material, so maybe I'll open it up to discussion at this point. Sorry about that.
Did you all miss my joke? Yeah, so I guess the focus is maybe what areas of mathematics could tell physicists something that they might not know about otherwise. I mean, that's one possible
sure.
thing here. So just a short list of things that occur to me. Sometimes a field as strange to the physicist as logic can give some information about landscape complexities. For example, in high dimensions, it's known that just like in lower dimensions, if you have a sphere, that you can a sphere in one of one lower dimension and one higher dimension, so like a two-dimensional sphere in three space, you might think. If you have a very wrinkled two sphere in three space, you can straighten it out, you know, sort of like blow air into it and straighten it out. And that remains true in higher dimensions, you know, like a five-dimensional sphere in six space, you can blow air into it and straighten it out. But something that's quite surprising that happens when the dimensions are a little bit higher is that the sphere might have to become much more wrinkled before it can start to straighten out. You have to go up over a pass before it starts to straighten out. And the only way we know this is by Gödel's theorem, by logic, because it's impossible to produce an algorithm for telling whether a fundamental group is trivial or not. And it follows from this that not only do you have to go over these high passes before the sphere becomes simpler, but the height of the passes is a non-recursive function of the initial complexity. So it's faster than any function you'd care to write down. So I think that, you know, I know from listening to seminars on string theory, people are interested in the complexity of landscapes of string vacuum and things like that. And it's interesting to know that sometimes from a very bizarre source like Gödel, you can get information. Of course, it's always discouraging information. let's see, maybe a more prosaic example, but which David touched on, is quantum groups. That's a beautiful subject, which produces candidate models for two-dimensional particle physics. So the representation theory of quantum groups should, you know, tell you what the superselection sectors of particles are in different kinds of theories. I mean, I think it's only the last 20 years or so that physicists have realized that in two dimensions, braid group symmetry rather than symmetric group symmetry is the relevant thing in two dimensions. And there is this beautiful mathematical tool which, in principle, should delineate the possibilities there. Maybe closer to more conventional solid-state physics is, you know, a lot of the solid-state physicists that I interact with are very interested in kind of locked-in topological structures like vortices and hedgehogs and skirmions and things like that. And of course, physicists are smart and they figure out these examples without any help. But it's possible that it's possible there are a few structures that might have relevance that haven't been found just because they're a little bit higher dimensional, or they involve some codimension restrictions, or basically the list that I just gave kind of comes from homotopy theory of very simple objects, and there might be a few other possibilities that would be interesting to solid state physicists that are hidden in topology. Let's see, before I give the microphone to the next victim, let me just suggest an opposite line of thought, which is, you know, not ask what mathematics can do for physics, but what can physics do for mathematics? So, of course, physics has inspired mathematics, and topology in the last 30 years or 25 years has been transformed by ideas from Ed Witten and Digraph and many other people, Greg Moore, to mention just a few. I think it's possible that, so, you know, ideas will come out, descend from physics, and mathematicians who pick up on them will get new insights. I think that it's conceivable that there are even more ambitious possibilities. I think it's possible that there are physical principles which could lead to a kind of argument that was outside formal mathematics. So let me give one example of this. I actually thought about this example night before last, and over lunch I asked Alexei Gataev, who's here now, if it made any sense, if it would work. And he told me no. And my experience is that he's not wrong ever. So with that caveat, let me make the following proposal. So there's this thing called Maxwell's demon that is supposed to create a perpetual motion machine by opening a little sliding window and letting molecules back and forth between two chambers. And a clever demon might be able to move the window open and close to create some pressure and run a perpetual motion machine. So, well, there are many analyses of this, and of course, probably you all know why it shouldn't work. But what I was thinking was mathematicians have been extremely poor at separating the complexity classes. And one of the great failings of modern mathematics is that there's no even reasonable idea of how to prove that P is not equal to NP, you know, that that certain classes of computational problems will be exponentially long to carry out. I mean, everyone believes this is true, but no one knows how to prove it. Well, maybe it can't be proved, or maybe we just aren't smart enough to prove it from ZF set theory, but maybe there's hydrodynamic or a thermodynamic argument for it, an argument that would use physical principles. Maybe if you suppose that this Maxwell demon was sufficiently good at computing, then he could, if he could make extremely difficult computations very fast, maybe he could somehow beat thermodynamics and create pressure in one side of the chamber. And if you could make such an argument, then by contradiction, you would have used physics to show that a certain mathematical conjecture is true.
I don't know if you get $1 million for that argument or not.
Well, you wouldn't have proved it within set theory, but mathematics should be flexible. You know, if we figure out that we can prove interesting things, by broadening our axiom base, we will.
Right.
Okay, I'd like to open the floor up to everybody, but perhaps first, since both I and the speaker focused on that, it's the famous Lot.
I mean, it's more of a comment that, you know, with for astrophysics, it's the opposite question, which is how much physics should an astrophysicist know? But that's a separate issue. And, you know, you could ask the same about other fields of, you know, biophysics and others, where mathematics isn't really the prime issue. But that's, today, it's not the prime issue. David's mumbling over here. It's not clear. And I think it's clear for, you know, very high redshift cosmology that there's clearly intersections there with physics where, you know, the mathematics might not well be at all in hand, but that's a very different endeavor. But no, so I don't have much more to add other than I think my statement's true.
Lars, how about the stability of the solar system?
Yes. No, it's obviously you can't find examples, but you're saying that for a large part of the universe, there are many branches of physics that are slightly to the side of the mainstream, where it's, you could, but that, the question is how much physics do you need? The interesting answer to string theory is how much physics they think they need to know.
I deliberately didn't give examples from string theory to try to keep the appeal of the talk broader than that, but obviously string theory has used a lot of modern mathematics, right? I mean, the amount of mathematics that you need to know to do string theory is a lot greater than most branches of theoretical physics.
Anybody else? Okay. I realize sort of what do you need to know and not how you need to know it or how you learn it. But sort of as a student, I'm trying to figure that out myself. And as an undergraduate, I found it a lot easier to learn the physics if I already knew the math. On the other hand, if I went and took a math course, you know, the mathematician stuck a bunch of epsilons and deltas in front of me, and I didn't really care if, you know, for all whatever there exists, whatever. That so I just wanted to know how to solve the problem. So, I mean, maybe that's the wrong attitude to take if you want to go into theoretical physics.
No, that shows it's the wrong attitude you want to take if you want to go into mathematics. But if you want to go into theoretical physics, you're doing just fine.
Well, I mean, do you have any suggestions, or does anybody have any suggestions?
David wants to respond.
Actually, I wanted to make another comment, but this point is an interesting point because, you know, at least until recently, interactions of theoretical physicists with mathematicians always suffered from this problem that the mathematicians are very leery to discuss things that don't have firm foundations or to accept arguments that aren't rigorous proofs, et cetera, et cetera. And some mathematical physicists would be of the same ilk.
Yes.
And they would warn you of the enormous dangers of, you know, thinking the way you're thinking and going out on these limbs. And I, of course, never bought it. But I wonder whether anyone knows examples where, I mean, it's true. We do all sorts of things and have done for years, and especially in systems with infinite number of degrees of freedom, starting in the 30s, certainly, which are, you know, have no rigorous foundation. Most of quantum field theory still has no. But so what? I mean, what has actually, where are there examples where this has been dangerous and in which physicists have gone to a lot of trouble by using folk theorems which turned out to be absolutely false? I mean, are there many such examples, or is somehow the intellectual rigor of theoretical physics strong enough that we somehow by intuition, experiment, whatever, avoid whatever dangers there are and are free to sail blithely on this thin ice?
So, I mean, I want to respond to that on several levels. In the first place, a mathematician when a result has been achieved, expects that it will survive unmodified for centuries, if not longer. And a physicist doesn't always think that. A physicist thinks that some closer approximation to a correct explanation has been achieved. So it's perhaps not as disconcerting to have to make a correction, to add another term, to realize that there really was a non-perturbative correction, whatever. And so the standards are quite different between when you think you're done with something. So that's reaction number one. Reaction number two is that there are a lot of, if quantum field theory is treated as a purely formal exercise, the way mathematicians like to treat things, so you're manipulating these quantities, then there are formal manipulations which lead to wrong answers, which look formally just as good as the formal manipulations that lead to right answers. And what guides the quantum field theorist to the truth is the understanding that there's some connection with physics, and to think about what the physical implication of the next step is, to realize which of the three possible shortcuts are now allowed. So can that be formalized? Well, people have tried over 60 years' time without succeeding so far. I think there probably is some mathematically honest version of quantum field theory, but you know, it's not one that we're familiar with at the moment.
My real point is just the dangers of mathematical sloppiness, which theorists are often willing to, aren't to me so evident in the history of the subject. It's not the biggest. The most severe opposition to quantum field theory happened by from the inventors of quantum field theory, like Dirac, who simply at some point said, this is mathematical nonsense, and I refused to look at it, which was a mistake, of course. Whereas the people who went ahead, even though it was mathematically nonsense, right, people
right.
were had great success. So, anyway, that's just a comment on the data.
Yeah.
Now, I think this was also contributed to the lack of dialogue to a large extent. And the mathematics community has actually learned to tolerate a bit of the sloppiness because it's...
Some of us have, anyway.
Some of you have, because it's produced results not just for theories of nature,
right,
but also for mathematics. But it's been a struggle, and it continues. But it's an interesting question. Why? How do we manage to avoid all of these dangers of incorrect or sloppy mathematical thinking often? The second comment, which might be related, is that you started off, as one often does in discussing mathematics and physics, with quoting Wigner. And remarking on, you know, how is it that this human invention is so effective in describing the natural world? Which, so I wanted to make a comment on that. I've done so in print on a years ago. But it seems to me it's self-evident in a way, since mathematics I regard as real as physics. It's a language, it's an elaborate language that we, creatures of evolution in the physical world, have developed in order to understand the physical world. And the only thing I would ever find surprising was that if there wasn't a match between both the elegance, beauty, and power of the intellectual tool that we have evolved and developed by a process of evolution to enable us to understand and control the physical world. All we're doing is discovering, you know, all you guys are doing are discovering structures out there in the language that we have developed to describe the physical world. So there's a reality to it which is tied to both the physical world and the our minds that have evolved to understand it, which is why it'll be isomorphic in any other solar system or galaxy. The mathematics there is undoubtedly exactly the same in structure and content.
So
that's my explanation of why it isn't... the only thing that would be unreasonable would be that this you know, this human creation, which it really isn't, it's really a human discovery, wasn't effective and wasn't elegant, you know, or wasn't appropriate for description of physical reality.
There are, however, a number of branches of mathematics which have no direct application to reality, and which number theory.
Well, people are struggling to find that, and furthermore, as you know very well, number theory is related more and more to other branches of physics which do have application. The whole thing is. And now we just learned how logic.
By listening to this, one thing that I believe within my own lifetime, within my own perspective, and thinking only in terms of facts, the utility of mathematics is useful for physics as a tool, it seems to me the most useful thing that mathematics can do is to limit the number of possibilities. So, for example, this Cartan classification of V groups and Dynkin diagrams, you draw and when you say to the mathematician, say to the physicist, you know, guys, these are the only possibilities.
Right.
Those are the things that are truly important to when the mathematician limit the number of possibilities rather than open up an infinite number of directions for physicists to look at. So, you know, with the kind of techniques that Gell-Mann had in the 60s, he tells his famous story, he was randomly commuting 3x3 matrices around. I mean, he would never have discovered this classification in the fact that there's only finite, so to speak, finite number of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to play devil's advocate or shower a little bit on the parade of, you know, how wonderful a tool math is, I mean, you know, a man with a hammer will use a hammer to solve whatever problem he has, right? So maybe math is one language we've actually found that has some application, maybe in reality very limited compared to some hypothetical other language or framework we could have to understand the real world. I mean, I remember in grad school working through some complicated problems, you know, all these field theory problems, and you do these calculations and you go through all this stuff, and in the end you get a pretty simple answer. But the manipulations it took to get you there, you start from something simple, you end with something simple, and in the middle is all this mess. So maybe if we had another framework, right, to do the calculation, it would be much easier. So it's just maybe math is just the hammer we have. And we don't have a chisel, which is what we really need. And it's just like, you know, when we have a nose, then we use the nose to prop our glasses up. It's not like the nose has evolved to be the best, you know, part of our anatomy to put glasses on. It's just we make use of it.
So let me just contrast the reaction of a physicist to the reaction of a mathematician to this experience that you relate of making a long computation and getting a simple answer. Physicist says, wow, I got the answer, that's great. And the mathematician says, as you did, I wonder if there's a theorem there that would let me shorten the computation. And the mathematician goes off and tries to find it. So I think, you know, mathematicians are tool creators rather than being just equipped with a single tool. And look, I mean, the infinite matrix mechanics that Heisenberg sort of developed to do his theory would have been unintelligible to Fourier or Newton. Both of the fields are progressing. They tend to progress using different strategies and goals. And it's when they get to talk to each other and interact that we make progress, I think.
Quite orthogonal to the discussion. There is another product of human activity which is called mathematica, which we all of us use each day, and that's the Wolfram's product. In fact, that tool is also very, very, very effective.
Mathematica.
Very effective in finding, which didn't exist some 20 years ago. There were various other computer programs, attempts to develop them, but that's very, very effective in checking conjectures in actually mathematicians probably use it to
It's changed the way mathematics is done.
Look for theorems, so it's really interesting part of the whole.
Really, everyone is involved.
Well, I think that you should also worry about the possibility that you know too much mathematics. Certainly, that's something I worry about. In the when I'm working on some problems, I'm wondering. I sometimes worry about, is it too much mathematics? I don't know. If you take some, you know, spin chains have nice physical applications in various forms. But if you start generalizing the spin chain and too much, you might leave the domain of physics and then just be working on a very interesting mathematical problem and developing some very interesting mathematics. But I think you have to worry about that. The physics can inspire mathematics, but it can then develop to something that loses its connections with the original physical problem.
Well, I always feel like I don't know enough mathematics, that if I knew a little more, I could solve the problems faster. But that's my main worry about mathematics.
Well, following up on what Juan just said, would you care to speculate how much more math is required to really understand string theory?
I like the story of the blind man and the elephant. The blind man and the elephant, right? The sense I think one still has after intense work on string theory for 25 years is that there is some underlying mathematical formulation of string theory that we don't understand yet. And I mean, I think we're more in the Newton or Fourier mode of needing something new to be invented and kind of groping our way towards what that might be. So it's hard to predict, since we haven't figured it out yet, it's hard to predict what it's going to look like or how much of a departure it's going to be. I don't think we have the right mathematical framework for describing string theory yet.
So I wanted to respond to two of the comments about what David was saying about math being kind of this reality, and the thing about knowing too much math, and also her comment about, it might be something else, right? Exactly. I was thinking that maybe it's not so much that you can know too much math, that there might be something else, but rather that there might be a danger in, a physicist being too much like a modern mathematician, or becoming too familiar with the modern, like the current language that we use to describe math. But there really is no such thing as knowing too much about reality or the world. But maybe, there is a danger in knowing too much about how some people here in our country have chosen to describe that reality and sort of getting too much into a culture or something like that. I was thinking that's probably more of the real danger.
Hi. So I guess I wanted to turn around Vigner's question from a mathematician's point of view, the unreasonable effectiveness of physics and mathematics. And I guess this is more a question than a comment. But as Mike alluded to, in the last 20 or 30 years, there have been a number of very important and surprising applications of techniques coming in physics and low-dimensional topology and other things. And to me, as a mathematical chauvinist, that seemed very surprising. I always felt very fortunate to be a mathematician because you've got like all of logical space to play around in, and these poor physicists are constrained by things related roughly to the real world, some infinitesimally small fraction of what one could be thinking about. And so it seemed, these seems like, having to stick with physical reality always struck me as some weird and unnatural isn't the right word. Some weird and arbitrary constraint on what we do. And yet, time and again, things that physicists do, including these dangerous non-rigorous techniques that David alluded to, come and give the right answers, and sometimes you get mathematical results that are clearly true, but we don't know how to prove them, but it's a familiar story. So to me, the surprising thing is that techniques developed to describe the real world are so effective in doing the sort of reality-free investigation that mathematicians like to do. So I don't know if anyone. Yeah. Okay.
Just two comments from an experimentalist. I'm lowest of all. First thing is that I've learned, the reason I'm an experimentalist is I've learned through bitter experience that nature has a much better imagination than I do. And so maybe that's why physics can be inspiring to mathematicians, because we have to figure out an answer and we don't even know the question. I mean, the hard part is finding the right question to ask. Second is how physics as a community has managed to not to stumble. I guess the right answer is we probably have a lot of times, but as a community we have enough contrarians around that we keep redoing the same calculations out of spite, more or less. And so a lot of times we have kind of these democratic things where, well, I don't really believe this guy's calculation, but kind of as a community we kind of converge on at least at this point in time was something that's considered the correct answer.
Further questions?